I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A 2018 poll of Americans aged 18 to 24 showed that 22% of respondents had never heard of a Holocaust. For Jews, this was troubling news as anti-Semitism has increased around the world, sometimes with deadly results. Today, why and how opposition and resentment against Jewish people are being expressed around the world and here at home. Then, when you think of music in Kansas City, country might not be the first genre that comes to mind, but it has a lot of fans in this town, and KC is a regular spot on the country concert circuit. Those very familiar with the music will take us on a guided tour of its development and influence. We'll get you up to date after the news. Professor Deborah Lipstadt says she once assumed that after the Holocaust, the world recognized where anti-Semitic rhetoric can lead. Now she says she knows she was wrong, especially after a gunman armed with an AR-15 assault rifle opened up at a synagogue in California in April. For Jews in 2019, their houses of prayer are not safe spaces. Haters abound. White supremacism flourishes. But why? How severe is the problem? That's our next topic today. With us, Deborah Lipstadt is a professor of modern Jewish history and Holocaust studies at Emory College in Atlanta. Her latest book, Anti-Semitism Here and Now, examines the recent rise in anti-Semitism in the U.S., the U.K., and Europe. Deborah, it's a pleasure to have you
here.
Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure being here.
Also here is Gavriella Geller. She's executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Bureau in Kansas City. Nice to have you. Welcome, Gabrielle.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah, how concerned are you with what you see out there these days, you know, when it comes to anti-Semitism? What's your take?
My take is that there is a precipitous rise in anti-Semitism, or let me adjust that. I'm not sure there's a precipitous rise in the number of anti-Semites, but there certainly is a rise in the number of people who feel free to express anti-Semitic hateful opinions and even to act on it.
What's the danger of expressing those views?
First of all genocides, Armenian, Holocaust, Rwanda, doesn't matter which one, begin with words. Mm-hmm. Not everybody who expresses the words will therefore lead to becoming a killer. Absolutely not. But someone will. Someone will be prompted to take action. The murderer in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh synagogue who killed 11 people, the murderer in San Diego, and not just in anti-Semitism, Dylan Roof in Charleston at Mother Emanuel Church. These were all people who were inspired first by words, and then they took action. So words matter. Words count.
Gavriella, what are you seeing from your perch in Kansas when it comes to this rise in anti-Semitism that Deborah's laying out here?
Well, thankfully, we're not seeing necessarily a significant rise in anti-Semitic activity here in our region quite yet. We do see, of course, this national pattern. And so I will say, particularly because our community has already faced an act of anti-Semitic violence back in 2014 when we had those shootings in the Jewish Community Center in Village Shalom, our community is on high alert.
I was going to say, are people nervous? Do you sense that as you get around?
Absolutely. The fear in the community is palpable. Our security, team has taken the necessary steps to ensure folks' safety. But I will just say that there is this overlying sense of fear in the community.
Steve, to jump in here, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the holiest part of the Jewish calendar is coming up. And I doubt that there's a synagogue in Kansas City, small, large, doesn't matter what ideological, theological view, that won't have a guard out front.
And by saying that, you're saying that almost every synagogue in the country will be in the same boat.
Absolutely. You'll have to identify yourself. People will have to know you. There'll be someone looking you up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not where we need to be, is it?
It's not what a synagogue should be. I was just in the Berkshires a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday morning driving through one of the many small towns there, and I passed the local Catholic church on the main street, and it was right the time for Mass, and the doors were wide open and
mm-hmm.
people were just streaming in and being welcomed but not being looked over and things like that. And it reminded me that there used to be a day like that for synagogues too.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, what do people, you know, say in your community about this tension, this need to be on constant alert? Because, I mean, that's more than just a drag, isn't it? I mean,
right. In some ways, it kind of conflicts with the idea of being this welcoming, open space as a house of worship should be. But I think that at the end of the day, unfortunately, our community knows only too well the importance of having those security measures in place. And so other sort of concerns have to take the back burner.
And none of that's cheap, right?
Oh, it is not cheap. It is also very sad that our community has to expend so many resources, both financial, you know, staff time, et cetera, on the security measures when we could be spending that money for programming and for outreach and for, you know, uplifting our community in other ways. So right now the Federation is actually undergoing a campaign to fund the next 12 years of security funding in the community. And it's very unfortunate that we have to do that. And
to add to that,
yes, please.
It's I think Gabriella has it exactly right that there's expenditure. Your question is right on target. But there's another cost. Kids walking into the synagogue look across the street at the church across the street, and they don't see a guard there. And suddenly, and for many of them, the synagogue is their happy place. They come on Saturday mornings. They play. They run around. They're with their friends. They have a great time.
There's a message getting sent there.
There's a message getting sent. That's right.
And it's not a message you want our kids to have.
It's not a message you want. It's not how you want kids to know about their identity, that they're under threat, or for that to be the main object. It turns their identity into object, what is done to us, mm-hmm. as opposed to what we do.
So, Deborah, what's different about what you're seeing today compared to a decade ago? Why is Deborah Lipstadt writing a book titled Anti-Semitism Here and Now?
Yeah, what's different is today, it's almost like a perfect storm. We're seeing it on the right, as we saw it in Pittsburgh and San Diego. We see it in websites. We see it in just dozens of different manifestations, if not hundreds. But we see it on the left also, less with violence and more with words and institutions. We see it from Islamist extremists. We see it from different directions all at once. And it's not a different forms of anti-Semitism. It's the same tropes, the same memes, the same stereotypes, but being expressed from different directions.
Why now?
I compare anti-Semitism to, and I don't mean this jocularly in any way, to a herpes virus. You know, there's certain kinds of herpes viruses that once you have them in your body, they can't be gotten rid of. They're embedded there. And I think anti-Semitism is like that. And it comes out in two situations, stress. So there may be economic stress, changing in values, talk about climate change, gay rights, all sorts of different things.
But the economy has been generally good, at least in this country.
Yes, you're making a very good point. You can't say these are disgruntled, out-of-work people. Not at all. But the society has changed, I think, and the changes in society lead to a lot of those things. I think some of it, irrespective of one's political outlook, a lot of people were disgruntled by having an African-American president. They just couldn't accept that. All these things put together lead to a hostility of which anti-Semitism is often a part. On the left, we see an institutionalization of anti-Semitism. I call it the last remaining vestige of the late Soviet Union. The Soviet Union started with the Zionism is racism, with a campaign of anti-Semitism. And some of that, and I know it sounds very weird and many people on the left will say, what's she talking about? But I trace it in the book,
mm-hmm.
That it has embedded, and you know, it often is concerned with the talk about Israel, and being critical of Israel is not anti-Semitism. You go to the Israeli Knesset, you'll hear severe criticism of Israeli policy. You read the Israeli press, you'll hear criticism of Israeli policies. But often the criticism is filled with anti-Semitic stereotypes, with depictions, cartoons that are clearly anti-Semitic, except in instead of saying the Jew, they say the Israeli.
You know, Deborah, we haven't mentioned two words yet, and that's President Trump, who's often blamed for a lot of this kind of tension, rightly, wrongly. You read about it a lot. What about that?
I don't know if President Trump is an anti-Semite, and I severely doubt it. But what he has done is, to my mind, sow seeds of discord, rouse up people about them and us, and often not directed at Jews, but all the people on the far right, the guy in Pittsburgh, San Diego, and people who just do things on the internet and say things and write things, have a sense that he supports them. When he said there were nice people on both sides in Charlottesville, nice people don't come to rallies organized by an alt-right, which is an overtly racist, anti-Semitic entity. His failure to overtly condemn this is problematic. Again, I'm not saying anything about him personally. I think he's very proud of his Jewish children, grandchildren, etc. But you can engage in a divisiveness when there should be healing.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the rise of anti-Semitism around the globe, not only here at home. If you want to join our conversation, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I should point out that Professor Deborah Lipstadt will be the featured guest for a reception and lecture 4:30 to 7 this evening at the UMKC Student Union. RSVP at rugroups.umkc.edu/event. Or just go to the UMKC website and kick around and you'll find that. That event is today, 4:30 this afternoon at the UMKC Student Union. You know, Gabriella, you know, in theory, we're supposed to be progressing as a world society towards a place where anti-Semitism is a thing of the long distance past. This conversation doesn't just suggest we're going anywhere remotely in that direction.
Unfortunately, I think it is exactly as Deborah has described, that anti-Semitism is so old. It is so pervasive, and it comes in waves. And it comes in waves that are spurred by certain, you know, societal circumstances. And so we can feel a little bit safe for a couple of years, and then we're where we're at right now, which is where you see an increase in hatred and hate crimes in general. Anti-Semitism will always be included in that picture.
You know, it may start with the Jews, but it doesn't end with the Jews. Mm-hmm. Or it may start with other groups. I mean, there's a rise in racist expression. There's a lot of hostility that people feel free to express. People feel free. There was just an incident in a school district in Washington, D.C., in a school in Washington, D.C., where a young boy in a middle school where there were a number of white students, black students, etc., was playing, I think, football with a couple of other students, and the white kid used the N-word on the African, towards the African-Americans. And when they looked up at him, he said, "And you can call me a racist, but I don't care." Well, that kid heard that from somewhere. Mm-hmm. He heard that from home. You hear these things, you repeat them, they become ingrained.
Yeah, go ahead.
There is one thing I want to say, though, which is that while we are all very concerned about the rise in anti-Semitism, it is also important for us to keep perspective and understanding that our organization, the Jewish Community Relations Bureau, now AJC as well, was founded in 1944 at a time when Jews were systemically discriminated against here in Kansas City. My own grandfather could not buy a house in Leawood because he was Jewish. Jews were not, you know, allowed to be a part of the downtown clubs. Right. They were, you know, barred from certain professions and things like that. That's not where we are right now. And so I think it is also important to understand that we have to keep our eye on and continue combating anti-Semitism, but also know that we are making progress in many ways.
Yeah, I think Gabriella raises a very important point, because also to many people, Jews don't present as the traditional victims of prejudice. They seem well educated. They seem well situated, though we know many are not. That's how it appears. Mm-hmm. They seem to be white, even though to the killer in San Diego and the killer in Pittsburgh, they were not white. The killer in Pittsburgh was yelling as the SWAT team was bringing him down, "You will not destroy the white race." Mm-hmm. So in other words, he did not see them as white. But they appear that way. So they say, well, what are they complaining about? But we know, and I'm very careful about making analogies to the 30s, to the Holocaust, to World War II, to Hitler period, the Nazi period, because they're often made too glibly and too superficially. But here, I'm willing to say that if you looked at the German Jewish community, it was solidly middle class, it was well situated, it felt itself an integral part of Germany, and this came.
Yeah. What do the two of you do to avoid getting discouraged about all this?
That's a great question. I think it's like I said before, I have to keep perspective. And Deborah also said it in her book that we have to also celebrate the richness and the vibrancy of Jewish culture today. American Jewish life is in an incredible place, and we have so much going on that we can be proud of. And I think engaging with our Jewish identities and with our Jewish community from that angle is really important to me, to not act and lead from a place of fear.
Yeah, as Gabi says, the last chapter of my book is called Oi, Not Joy. Yeah, Joy, Not Oi. Excuse me, Joy, Not Oi. That you have to be conscious of the negative, but you can't let the negative shape your worldview. Otherwise, you become object and not subject.
Yeah. I think the other thing for us is I feel very fortunate to be going to a job every day where I'm actively working to build bridges, and not just, and I think the language is important here, but not just combat anti-Semitism, but being proactive in trying to heal our communities and bring our communities together and build peace.
Which is an optimistic journey by its definition, you're saying.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Florence from Kansas City, Kansas. Florence, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve and Jess. My question is, could the guest speak about what fuels anti-Semitism? What does she feel? What does she think is the root cause of anti-Semitism that we see? What fuels it?
Right. Thanks, Florence.
What fuels it?
Yeah.
It's a great question.
It is.
I think it's very important in terms of prejudice not to look at the person who is the object of prejudice. It's not what an African American might do that causes racism. The racism, you know, you cannot, an African American or a Jew or a gay person, whatever it might do something wrong and you dislike that person. But if a blonde person does something wrong and you say, oh, I hate all blonde people because of that, people would think you're crazy. So it's something embedded in the person who is becoming the purveyor of the hatred. Anti-Semitism is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, hatred in the world. It goes back to the Middle Ages, to the way in which there were Christian theologians in the church in the Middle Ages, depicted Jews, depicted Judaism. Not all, not everyone, but it was a very strong element in the Middle Ages. And then it worked its way from the church to people like Karl Marx on the left, the communist who hated all religion. But when he wrote about Jews, he wrote about it. He could have been talking in the most traditional forms of anti-Semitism. It goes to science. So it's a hatred that's there. Mm-hmm. And if you say, oh, the Jews did this, people say, oh, maybe there's something to it. If you said the bicycle riders did this, they would say you're crazy.
Mm-hmm. Florence, thanks for the call. Let's go to Rich from Overland Park. Rich, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about anti-Semitism. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I think it's very important that leaders in the Jewish community speak out not only about what's going on, but how things like this develop, and how they've developed historically, and how these same methods that have been used to persecute Jews have also been used to persecute other classes of people. And I noticed in a run-up to the show, it was mentioned that a certain group of young people didn't even know about the Holocaust. And so there's a huge educational lacking there that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. Gabriella, you buy that, what Rich just said?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that if I can take it in sort of two parts, the first being that we need to be speaking out against hatred of all minorities, and we could not agree more. That is our approach, and that is the core essence of our work. In fact, Deborah actually sits on the Muslim Jewish Advisory Council of AJC, which is our national affiliate, and we have a local Muslim Jewish Advisory Council that we've had here for a few years and are continuing to expand strategically. So we believe very strongly in building those coalitions and standing up together against hatred of all people.
You know, Deborah, our listeners might recognize your name because you once had a libel suit filed against you by a Holocaust denier named David Irving. All this became fodder for a 2016 film titled Denial, and you wound up writing a book about it, History on Trial. I can't help but ask, how surprised were you to be sued over whether the Holocaust existed or not?
I was flabbergasted. He sued me in a British court. My book had been published as well as in the United States, published in Britain, so he had grounds to sue me there. And in Britain, in the United Kingdom, libel law is the mirror image of American libel law. In America, if I say you lied about me, you libeled me, I have to prove you lied about me. In England, if I say you libeled me by what you wrote about me, you as the author have to prove the truth of what you said. Mm. So I had to fight back, otherwise he would have won by default. And this is a man who had said, you know, I'm going to sink the battleship Auschwitz. More people died in Senator Kennedy's car in Chappaquiddick than died in gas chambers at Auschwitz, which, of course, you know, one person died. And so, in other words, no people died in gas chambers. That Hitler was the best friend the Jews had. So when I first saw the lawsuit, when I first saw the papers filed, I thought it was ridiculous. I laughed.
Yeah.
Later, I became more serious about it when I understood the ramifications. And actually, it was a lawsuit that lasted from beginning to end for about six to seven years. I won a tremendous victory thanks to a great legal team, thanks to wonderful support and cutie from the AJC, which Gabriella is associated with. And the judge ended up calling him a neo-Nazi polemicist, a liar, a racist, and an anti-Semite. So it was worth it.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. That's the voice of Professor Deborah Lipstadt. You can see her this evening, 4:30 at the UMKC Student Union. More information on rugroups.umkc, just to check out that event. Also here, Gabriella Geller, Executive Director of the Jewish Community Relations Bureau in Kansas City. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Appreciate it. Yeah. When we come back, we're going to talk about the music that Kansas City's not maybe best known for, not jazz, but country music. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Kraske Off Mic is my weekly newsletter available at kcur.org/Kraske. Chuck Haddix gets it. There's exclusive content from me and highlights from the up-to-date team sent right to your inbox every Monday. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, novelist Salman Rushdie will join us to discuss his latest novel, Quichotte, that just made the Booker Prize shortlist. We'll ask what inspired him to write this take on the classic Don Quixote. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City is known as a jazz town, of course, but as we're about to find out, it also has its roots in country music. It's a good time to review that history with Ken Burns' latest documentary, Country Music, about to premiere on PBS come September 15th. With us now to talk about Kansas City's ties to country music are Chuck Haddix, the host of The Fish Fry, heard here each Friday and Saturday evening. He's also the director of the Mar Sound Archives at UMKC. Chuck, always good to have you. Welcome.
Good to be in the house, Steve.
Joey Peterson has been part of the Kansas City radio scene since 1992 on a series of radio stations, including KCMO-AM and WDAF-AM. She's a co-host of financial talk shows in Kansas City and Omaha. Joy, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Chuck, most people don't think of Kansas City as a country music town. How accurate is that view?
Well, it's not accurate at all. I mean, Kansas City's always been a cow town since the very beginning.
That's right.
And country music, let's face it, when you get cowboys
and cows,
a lot of cattle,
yeah,
well, you got country music.
Yeah. Joey, this town has got a lot of country music fans, no question about that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. We were just talking off the air before we came on. The fact that a market this size has three country radio stations and they're all doing well and producing ratings, you know, if there was just one country station in town, it would be blowing everybody else out of the water.
Is that unusual to have three then, you're saying?
Yeah, for a market this size. Usually, yeah. Maybe, depending on where you're at, maybe one, maybe two, but they usually don't fare real well if you have a whole bunch of them. But hey, we've got three here and they all play great music, a little bit different on each station.
That's
the kind of music you get.
Yeah.
But yeah, they all do really well.
You know, Chuck, this town has long been on the country music circuit. Where do the great artists used to play here in town when the legends came?
Well, when the legends came through, they played bigger venues, like, for example, Memorial Hall. But Genova's Chestnut Inn at 12th and Chestnut was really one of the main clubs for many years here in Kansas City through the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Cash, Wanda Jackson, Merle Haggard, everybody played at Genova's Chestnut Inn. Now, I know people think of me as a jazz guy and a blues guy, but actually, I cut my teeth on country music.
Is that right?
Yeah, my uncle Raymond Scotty owned a series of clubs. He owned the Frontier Club, the 3900 Club, the Silver Spur, and he also owned the Wander Inn, which was at 12th and Spruce. And my mother used to call it the Wander Inn Stagger Out. and he was with Patsy Cline and Cowboy Copas and Hawkshaw Hawkins the night before that fateful crash.
Hmm.
Over in Kansas City,
yes.
Kansas, drinking whiskey and carrying on. He knew everybody. Wanda Jackson played his place. So when I was a kid, I grew up, you know, immersed in country music.
You know, Joy, what country stars have you seen here in Kansas City over the years?
Oh, my goodness.
Like all kinds?
All kinds of them. I used to go to, like, the Northtown Opry in North Kansas City. Byron Jones was there, and he would bring in some of the more classic artists from the 70s and 60s. And then when I started in the 90s, I saw Garth Brooks at the Wyandotte County Fair.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Before anybody knew who he was playing the Wyandotte County Fair.
The country music of today sure ain't your grandparents' country music, though. Am I right about that?
It's a lot different.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pop
influence. I was going to say, it kicks harder and everything else, right?
A lot of bass to it, you know.
Yeah.
But I think there is still a hunger for the classic sound. So you still have some artists that are putting out some really good classic sounding music, like Easton Corbin and Craig Morgan. Some of those guys they're still doing some classic sounding country.
Has this evolution of country served it well, Chuck?
Well, I think it has, because it's attracted a broader audience, and you can't exist as a museum piece. Music does not exist as a museum piece. It has to evolve. But then again, you have to remember where it came from, too, and pay homage to those earlier artists. And there's a real hunger for traditional country. I see it in people that come in the Mars Sound Archives and, you know, in the Fish Fry, whenever I play the country stuff, too, people really like that.
Yeah. You know, one of the points of Ken Burns' series is that country music has roots in immigrants to this country and the slaves who once toiled here in Africa, in the blues. I mean, it's going to be a new way of looking at country music, right? At least that's my take on what Ken Burns is about to present.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see if how it compares to his documentary on jazz, because jazz was very controversial because of the things he left out.
Yes.
And I believe they've already kind of issued a disclaimer that they couldn't include everybody, because country music happened all over the country. And it's a very, very wide-ranging style of music, and with roots in a lot of different communities.
Your point being that jazz was more focused in towns like New Orleans, Kansas City, New York, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
When they came, I did some work with them, consulting work with jazz. And when they came to Kansas City, they had not written anything about Kansas City in the narrative. And soon they discovered that they had a little catching up to do, and they gave Kansas City short shrift, but fortunately we were able to include it.
Mm-hmm.
And also they included 30 years of jazz from 1960 to 1990 in one episode. That's Ornette Coleman. That's John Coltrane. That's Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to have maybe some issues like that with this new film.
You know, Joy, can you hear some of those early influences in country music in the early country? I mean, you know, blues and immigrants, slave music that got attached to country music early on?
Oh, definitely. You know, you were talking about the local scene. When you look at the, like, the Appalachian Mountain communities and stuff, they all had their own pre-Opry Opry's, you know, where people would get together and they would play their fiddle or their banjo or whatever on the front porches at the local barn dance or whatever. And then when
that's the stuff I'd like to
hear.
Yeah.
It was a lot more what we consider bluegrass now. But then it kind of merges into what we have today. And I think a lot of that has to do with the Grand Old Opry come into radio widestream, because it brought that local, you know, backwoods type music to a general population.
That's interesting.
And of course, you know, there's a whole tradition of old timey music in the Ozarks. And that's what really informed the sound of Kansas City country music, because those artists all migrated here.
That's interesting.
Great country artist Jimmy Dallas was from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, then before even, but when and Kansas City has a long tradition of country music on the radio. KMBC had a very popular program called the Brush Creek Follies from 1938 to 1952. It was a weekly program, and they had groups like the Texas Rangers, the Oklahoma Wranglers, Tex Owens, and I mean, it was country. Mr. Arthur B. Church looked around, you know, around Kansas City, and he saw all the farmland, and so he developed his country programming, and that was some of the more popular programming. And actually, he developed a transcription service that was distributed over the CBS network that featured some of these country artists.
Wow.
So it came out, it covered the whole country.
You know, Joy, there's always struck me, there's something so welcoming about old traditional country music. I mean, it's always struck me as friendly music.
A lot of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's some dark sides to country
music.
Of course,
no question about it.
But I think the thing is that it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Most
maybe
of the
that's
music,
the word. Yeah.
It comes
authentic,
from,
yeah.
Yeah, it comes from the heart. These people who wrote their songs, they were writing their truth.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear that in a song and it touches you emotionally, there's an immediate connection.
Yeah. Listen, Chuck, you brought some music with you, and I wanted to run through some of that. Now, tell us about this Hank Snow tune you brought, Letter Edged in Black.
Well, Letter Edged in Black was published here in Kansas City in 1897 by the Kansas City Talking Machine Company. It was written by a woman named Harriet Woodbury under the pseudonym of Hattie Nevada. It sold 300,000 copies nationally for 50 cents a piece.
Wow.
And this is the first really published country ballad that went national. And it was covered by Johnny Cash, Hank Snow. Everybody covered the Letter Edged in Black. And in those days, when you would have a death in the family, a relative would send another relative a letter that would be edged in black, indicated that someone had died in the family. And so this is a story of a young man that receives a letter from his father about the death of his mother. And it's an enduring country classic, and it came right out of Kansas City.
Who's Hank Snow?
Hank Snow was a very popular
hear.
Artist
yes.
during the 1960s and 50s.
Yeah.
And he's Mr. Country, really.
Okay. Let's listen to Hank Snow, this tune, Letter Edged in Black.
A happy face and a jolly head. He rang the bell and whistled as he waited. And then he said, "Good morning to you, Jack." But he little knew the sorrow that he brought. He handed me a letter edged in black. With trembling hand, I took that letter.
Well, that's real country music.
That is.
Oh,
country
it is.
Music.
And that's about as real as it gets, I gather, right?
There are common themes in country music. Mama's one of them. getting drunk, trains.
Yeah. Oh, wait a second.
And,
now you're just.
And
you're
rain. Just... And Steve Goodman wrote this funny song called You Never Even Call Me By My Name, and he sent it to David Alan Cohen. He said, this is a perfect country song. And David Alan Cohen said, there's nothing about country. There's nothing about mama, prison, getting drunk, rain, or train. Yeah, and so he added the refrain. He goes, I was drunk the day my mom got out of prison. Yeah. And I went to pick her up in the rain. And just as he got there, she got ran over by a doggone train.
Was it that version of the song we just heard that sold 300,000 copies?
Yes. Well, it was recorded by Vernon Dalhart and also Fiddlin' John Carson in 1924.
Yeah.
Another interesting connection locally is Ralph Peer, who produced the Bristol Sessions and recorded the first country song, Little Log Cabin Down the Lane, was from Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And he got his start here in the record business. And he, at the same time he was recording country music, he was recording Benny Moten, and he was also the first one to record Crazy Blues. Hmm. And so Ralph Peer had this connection to Kansas City.
All right, let's move on to another one here. This is... a radio program, Life on the Red Horse Ranch. Why did you bring that one, Chuck?
Well, this is from 1935, and it's a transcription service by KMBC for distribution over the CBS network. And this features a group called the Texas Rangers. From 1930 to 1939, they were one of the most popular groups in Kansas City and nationally. They were in Gene Autry Westerns, and they were regular on a radio program called the Brush Creek Follies, which was broadcasted from the Ivanhoe Temple and Memorial Hall from 1938 to 1952.
Wow.
And in those days, stations did not have programming, so they distributed these 16-inch discs to be played and then to return to the source. And this is a program called Life on a Red Horse Ranch, and it's a horse opera. And it's a dramatic, but the Texas Rangers jump in and perform a little ditty that's funny.
Let's listen.
A few thrilling moments from drama and music will conclude our studio visit. It's from a program that is sponsored over 30 stations and KMBC's newest radio success. Life on the Red Horse Ranch.
Well, half the herd of the Red Horse gone. Stolen by rustlers. I can't believe it.
Oh, Dad. What are we going to do now?
Well, believe me, if I'd have had my say, nothing like this would have happened. But I tell you, Mr. Carter, those rustlers were too far ahead of us. Besides, I didn't want anyone to get hurt.
Listen, Mr. Carter, I'm asking you again. Let me and the boys go after them rustlers.
No alibi. No, it's too late. The tide is starting to rain.
Oh, but, Dad, don't give up, please. The boys want to help you.
If there was an ounce of spunk in Bradford here, why, he'd say the same thing.
I've taken about all I'm going to offer you, alibi.
Mr. Carter, for heaven's sakes, listen to me. Don't let Steve Bradford and his slick tongue ruin you.
Now, Alabama, I think that you've said about enough.
Well, not half as much as I'd like to say. Well, if you want me again, you'll find me in the bunkhouse. Good night.
Yeah, there. That's Life on the Red Horse Ranch. That's what people used to listen to back in the day.
Yeah, that's right. Only the Texas Rangers come in after this, and they perform this little ditty, country music, and it features Fred Pryor on bass.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, Fred Pryor of...
The Fred Pryor.
The Fred Pryor on bass, yeah.
Let's get to one final one here, Chuck. You Can't Take It With You from the Westport Kids, circa 1955.
This is a group that was a family band featuring the Westport Kids. From, they were very popular here locally in the 1950s, basically starting in 1950 to 1955. And they recorded for the they had the Westport label, and they played all over town these jubilees like the Cowtown Jubilee and these other shows. So they were very popular, and they're called the Westport Kids.
Let's listen.
You can't take it with you when you go. Take it with you, you can't take it with you. You can't take it with you when you go. Enjoy it while you have it, cause it's just borrowed dough. For you can't take it with you when you go. While working slave your whole life through, life's shorter than you think. Brother, better enjoy yourself.
yourself while you're still in the pink, or you can't take it with you.
I think that gives you a pretty good idea, Joy. That's what it used to sound like. That's also real stuff. So Kansas City does have roots in country music. We'll learn more when Ken Burns' documentary airs on PBS come September 15th. I want to thank Joy Peterson for coming in today, and Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry. Thank you both very much for a good roundup of our roots in country music.
It makes me want to go have a drink.
You know, I was just like going to, or something like that, right? Take me with you. Coming up, Brian McTavish and some fun stuff to do this weekend. What are the chances that we end up dancing like two in a million, like once in a life, that I could have found you, put my arms around you, like two in a million, like once in a life. What are the chances? If I had an X for your name, the time had to stop when you said it to me. Of all of the plans that I couldn't make, of all of the nights that I couldn't sleep, what's a girl like you doing a face I did? That sounds to me like the Backstreet Boys. Brian McTavish is here to round up some fun stuff to do this weekend, and welcome back. Good to have you.
Boys.
Backstreet Boys.
More like men.
That's what they call themselves.
Well, there's not much of a brand in Backstreet Men.
Yes.
If so, certainly not one we'd want. No, yes. Backstreet Boys, they now range in age from 39 to 47.
Is that right?
But boys sells. Boys sells. The boys make that Men Are Back in Town, 8 o'clock Saturday night at Sprint Center. They still pack a swoon-worthy punch, Steve.
Do they?
For you, I'm sure, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the thing. They had female fans 25 years ago. They have female fans now. No longer girls themselves,
mm-hmm.
Right? They're on their world tour in support of their latest album, DNA, which might as well stand for Deep Nostalgia in Action.
Ah.
More than 25 years. Wow. Nick,
long time.
Nick, well, yeah, it goes by just like that. Nick, Brian, Kevin, AJ, and Howie, they're still moving, grooving, dancing, prancing. The Golden Oldie song list includes We've Got It Going On, Quit Playing Games With My Heart, and their monster hit. Everybody knows this. I mean, everybody, I Want It That Way.
Oh,
not
yeah.
This way, but that way, right? I'll Never Break Your Heart, they promise. I don't know. Oh, and there's The One, and when they sing The One, take it from me, everybody in that place is going to be thinking, they're singing to me. So
wow.
Have fun with the boys or the men Saturday at Sprint Center.
Walk this earth till this curse won't come back again. Be my road, be my home, my bad weather friend. Walk this earth till this curse won't come back again. Oh, child, goodbye.
That's Madison Ward and the Mama Bear, and they are good.
Yeah, double good.
Real good.
Yeah, good squared for sure.
Yes.
And they're just one of the acts among the scads of local bands that'll be performing Saturday and into the wee hours Sunday this weekend at Crossroads KC at Grinders, plus five or six other stages in the Crossroads Arts District.
Mm.
Madison Ward and Mama Bear, they are headlining a 7 o'clock show Saturday at Crossroads KC at Grinders.
They've really done well for themselves.
Well, yeah. The video of this song actually has celebrities kind of singing along. I mean, they've done the national TV circuit. They've been around a few years, really making a name for themselves. Of course, Madison is the son, and his mother, Mama Bear, is Ruth. Opening for them at Crossroads KC will be Split Lip. They'll be ripping it.
Yeah.
Trust me, Split Lip Rayfield, because they specialize in something called bluegrass metal, unless I just made that up. Also, let's put a shout out to just some of the bands that are all around that area Saturday. Violet and the Undercurrent, Fred Wickham and the Hattacall Caravan, Hannah Norris and the Band, Molly Gina and the Gasoline, Steve and Brian. I just made that up.
Wow.
But what if we went?
Went?
Okay, and Drumlines. Yeah, you like that? I gave you top billing.
Yeah.
The Python's Drill Team and Willie Arthur's Smith's Marching Cobras. Yes, the Marching Cobras are part of the Crossroads action on Saturday. Get sucked into the Sonic Celebration.
I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, take it to go. Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm strong to the finish, cause I eat the spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
You know, you think of Popeye, you think of spinach, and away we go,
hey,
right?
That's right. Let's go there. So Popeye the Sailor Man, the brilliant comic strip creation of E.C. Segar in 1929 or thereabouts. And you'll get to meet him and his girlfriend Olive Oil and the little tyke they take care of, Sweepy, at, yes, the Lenexa Spinach Festival. Popeye proclaims, and so should we, Saturday at Socar Par Trails Park in Lenexa. I'm strong to the finish, because I eats me spinach. Also, the Greek Food Festival, authentic Greek food, pastries,
wow,
music, dance, and
love
pastries.
Love pastries.
Friday night, Saturday, Sunday at the Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church, 1200 block of Warnell Road. Two words, baklava, cheesecake.
Yes.
See you there.
Good words. And there's a lot going on this weekend. There's just a lot happening.
We got to keep going.
I know.
We got to keep going.
Let's talk about wine here a little bit, shall we?
Yeah, and the more wine you drink, the more you want to talk about it,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Or sing about it when you shouldn't be.
I like that song.
I like that song. Written by Neil Diamond, long ago and far
away.
Neil is somewhere cashing the royalty check as we speak. Okay,
yes.
It's Uncorked. The KC Wine Fest.
Yes.
150 wines, gourmet food trucks. There's a DJ. Now, there's a photo booth from 1 to 9 Saturday at Union Station, right? Now, the photo booth... Here's what people should do. Try a before and after drinking pic, right? No?
Yeah.
Could be very upsetting if you...
Yes.
You know, if you prefer the after, then you might have to have a conversation with a significant other. Okay, so that's that. KC Wine, Saturday, Union Station. But if you don't want to drink alcohol, you want to drink something that's like caffeine instead, check out the Midwest Tea Festival. Tea merchants, tea tastings, tea talks, tea workshops, t-shirts... No doubt. 10 to 5 Saturday and Sunday at the Bennett Auditorium at the Ararat Shrine Temple.
Okay, and finally today.
Finally.
There's Lady Gaga.
And there's some art. Art can be a moving experience,
yes,
as we all know. It moved Lady Gaga to pen her song Venus, which we are currently enjoying under my voice. And Venus was inspired by Botticelli's 15th century painting, The Birth of Venus.
My goodness.
So there you are. So prepare
very
to be...
Very sophisticated.
Very. So be sophisticated or otherwise, but perhaps be inspired. Maybe even write a song about this year's Art Westport event. 150 or more local artists offering their creative wares on the streets of Westport. But let me give you a little something else going on. Also, don't miss, just a couple of blocks away, it's the Lost Arts Fair. It's a companion event presented by the Westport Historical Society. It's at the 1855 Harris Carney House Museum. You can take a horse-drawn carriage back and forth. You can see displays of old-timey things like blacksmithing, textile spinning, corset making, and very quickly but meaningfully, also check out the Kansas City Chalk and Walk Festival at Crown Center. Pro, student, amateur chalk artists of all ages and persuasions, projecting their imaginations onto brick canvases.
Good luck picking out what to do this weekend, because there's so many choices. The Chiefs play at noon Sunday, and away we go.
How did we get by? You mentioned it.
Very good. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, buddy.
Many thanks.
Thousands of Missourians, mostly children, have lost Medicaid coverage since last year. Yesterday, two state representatives offered different viewpoints on the issue. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, award-winning novelist Salman Rushdie will join us to discuss his new book, Quichotte, that just made the shortlist for this year's Booker Prize. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.